My name's Adrian Troy, and I'm a professor at Carnegie Mellon University, and I'm going to be talking about crowdsourcing science. And this is a small enough and intimate enough space that I'm going to say it would be awesome if you guys want to ask questions. And I can see you all, so just jump in the middle, and that'll be totally fun. But please ask questions at the microphone so that the folks back home can hear you. Okay? Awesome. Okay, so I'm going to talk about crowdsourcing science. Now, what do those two very hip words mean next to one another? Let me give you an example, protein folding. So as many of you may know, proteins are these gorgeous molecules which get created at an astonishing rate in each one of our cells, and they fold up into these complex shapes that carry out all of the basic functions of cellular life. But the protein folding problem specifically is, given a sequence of amino acids, we want to find the 3D shape that the protein folds into. And this is considered one of the grand challenges in biology today. It's really a key to understanding how life works at the cellular level. And it's something that scientists have devoted huge computational resources for. Literally large supercomputers or networks of thousands of computers collaborating together across the world. So this is a protein folding right here. But it's not being folded by an algorithm or some supercomputer. Actually, this protein is being folded by an 11-year-old boy in upstate New York. And this is a game which we created called Fold It. And this boy is actually one of over 300,000 Fold It players around the world who are competing and collaborating to fold proteins. Let me give you another example, RNA nanoengineering. So this problem is actually the opposite of protein folding, if you think about it. In this case, the shape is known. It's something, we want you to create something in this shape. And the goal is to come up with a sequence of amino acids in this case, because we're dealing with RNA, which will naturally fold into this shape in the body. And this is considered a key to creating next generation catalysts and drug responsive control elements like ribo switches. And so for this too, we created a game. This is a nanoengineering interface that we designed. And the game is called Eterna. And it's similar to Fold It, but it sort of takes the concept one step further. Every week, Eterna players vote on which one of their designs they think will be most successful. And then we take the top voted designs and actually synthesize them in the lab with high throughput biochemistry and send back the results to players as score. So if you think about it, this is a computer game which is actually crowdsourcing the entire scientific method from hypothesis to experiments to result. And it can all be done from your living room on your laptop. So, these are the two games I'm going to be talking about. Fold It was a little bit older. It was launched in 2008. It's a protein folding game. It has about 300,000 players now, and it deals with computational chemistry. Eterna was launched, we just had its first year birthday, actually. It's an RNA nanoengineering game. It has about 35,000 players, and it deals with experimental chemistry in the sense that players are scored based on how the molecules they design actually fold in the real world. And so when we started to create these games, we had this idea, and it sort of went a little bit like this. Well, we're scientists, and we have these really interesting hard problems, so we're going to convert them into computer games, and then we're going to get a bunch of people to solve these problems for us, so that way we don't have to do any more work. And that seemed like such an awesome idea, and just like a fun thing to do. We had no idea whether it was going to work. We had really no idea what was going to happen. And interestingly, it didn't work out at all like we thought. Instead of being this simple linear progression, the players changed the games. As soon as we injected these games into the fabric of the internet, players started doing completely different things than we expected. And that changed the game as we responded to what they were doing, which changed the underlying scientific problems we were solving and changed the scientists, and all sorts of crazy things came out of this. So it turned into this really nonlinear process, and I'd like to tell you some of the stories of what came out of this process. And so I'm calling this talk 10 Reasons to Crowdsource Science. Okay? So, reason number one. Games make us understand. So, people ask me, why did these games work so well? Why did Fold It and Eterna work? And one of the main reasons is that we knew nothing about biochemistry. We were working with biochemists who knew a lot, but we didn't understand anything. And so in some sense, we tried to look at these sort of exotic phenomena, like proteins, right? Through the eyes of a child, what does it mean if you were to see something like this and play with it? And as a result, we created interfaces, user interfaces that looked like nothing else on the market. I mean, before Fold It and Eterna, this is what a serious scientific user interface looked like, right? And instead of just doing pure computational science, we tried to find like visual metaphors, like are used in computer games, to convey to players what these things actually feel like, what it feels like to play with them, what sorts of operations can you do on a protein, and also what sorts of forces happen when you push a protein or push an RNA around. And so it was a really interesting thing to try and create these user interfaces for these exotic things, and it turns out that in many respects they're much less complicated than people think. And so an interesting thing happened with these interfaces, which is that real scientists, real serious scientists, loved them. There was absolutely nothing on the market which looked anything like these games. And in fact, we've created a sort of top secret expert version of Fold It, which is now being used in biochemistry labs around the world for graduate students and postdocs and professors to design proteins without the gamification layer on top. And likewise, in the case of Eterna, we were recently contacted by a pharmaceutical company which said, this interface is totally awesome. We want to put it on our website so that people who order RNAs from us know what they're ordering. And so this thing happened twice independently with two different projects like this. And I think that what it means is that there's actually something very powerful here at the intersection of modern computer graphics and interactive techniques and these hard scientific disciplines. And I'm calling this interactive biology. And I think that this has a lot of implications, not just for games, but also for training, for education, and really for how scientists themselves look at the things that they're studying every day. So, that's the first reason to crowdsource science. The second reason is kind of a biggie, and that's that humans can actually solve hard problems. And I think we should all pat ourselves on the back, because we are still capable of doing many things, even very complicated things, that computers can't do. I don't know how long that's going to last, but for now we're still a little bit ahead. So let me give you an example. Here are some results from Fold It. And so these are actually three protein shapes superposed on one another. And the blue is the native conformation, so this is the right answer, which we know in this case from a process called X-ray crystallography. The red is the best computer solution, and the cyan is the best player solution. And the important thing to look at is that little residue sticking out on the bottom right-hand corner. So that's called a hydrophobic residue, which means that those molecules don't like to be touching water. And guess what's all around a protein? Water, right? So in fact, nature, so the chemical forces acting on this protein are certainly going to push that residue so it's pointing inwards and not outwards. That's why it's called hydrophobic. And in fact, if you talked to a biochemist who has, you know, who looks at proteins all day long, they'd say, of course, yeah, there's something wrong about that protein. But the interesting thing is that a computer, for all of its power, was not able to find that correct fold, even though it could look through millions and millions of possibilities. And it never found the right thing, and it still left that hydrophobic residue pointing outwards. Whereas players are able to just look at that and say, there's something wrong about this, after we train them. There's something wrong about this. There must be some way I can fold that inwards. Yeah?
Are you folding in a vacuum where you don't have those external forces acting
So the question is this being folded in a water environment, or is it being folded in a vacuum where these forces wouldn't act upon it? In nature, it will certainly be folded in water, right? In the game, we have energy terms. So an interesting thing about folded is that it's based on one of the best energy models of how protein folds. And in fact, your score in folded is really the same model that top scientists use to figure out how good your protein is. All we do is like add 10,000 to it to make it seem like more like a score. And you know, a bunch of zeros at the end, right? Like Vegas uses this trick too. But we're really using the real model. And indeed, that model has energy terms which take into account the fact that it's in water. So yes, you will theoretically score higher if you do the right thing here. But the computer still can't find the right solution, which is very interesting, right? And now, if some of you are in computer science, you might say, now look, this doesn't seem that hard. I mean, look, you have to write a little program that detects when it's out there, and then you have to write a little program that tucks it in. Okay. If you can solve that problem for me, I've got a little gift for you. It's called a PhD. Yeah, this is a hard problem. And we've actually been able to show that players could repeatedly solve protein puzzles that the best computers couldn't solve. It's pretty exciting. And published a paper at Nature recently and several more since then. Let me give you another example. This one from Eterna. So this is a target shape that we invented. We asked players, build us molecules that fold into this shape. We call it a five-bulge star. And here are some of the player designs that you can see here. And you can see that they look a lot like the target. There's a couple errors. And also, let me point out that in the case of Eterna, all of these results are empirical. These are actual molecules that we synthesized, and that's really the shapes they folded into. And these are the top designs created by a computer. All right? So there's a gap between the model of reality that a computer has and what really happens when you do this in a test tube. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that later. But the bottom line here is we can train people to solve problems which are beyond the reach of even the fastest computers right now. And I think that's very exciting. And that brings me to the third reason to crowdsource science, which is it's just a total rush to create these games. I mean, I was trained in academia, and I wrote papers with lots of equations in it and stuff. I'm sure some of you know what I'm talking about. And this is the first time I started making things for real people that, you know, would respond to what we were doing, tens or hundreds of thousands of people. And here in South by Southwest, maybe many of you have had that experience, but it's a really unbelievable experience. And I remember when we first created Foldit, we literally became, after it was released, we were totally addicted to it. We were on the chat all the time, talking to one of the players. And one of the undergrads, engineers who worked on it, told me this story one day, which is that he was talking to one of the players, maybe telling him about some keyboard shortcuts or something, and the player was like, whoa, you sure know a lot about Foldit. And the engineer said, thank you, I was actually one of the programmers of Foldit. And the player said, really? And the engineer said, yes. And the player said, you are a god. And I mean, that doesn't happen to undergrads very much. And it's just really, really exciting to just do work with this many people. And people are really amazing technologies, really. And so, you know, in computer science, we're getting super excited about this idea of machine learning, right? Big data. How can we teach computers to do amazing things with enough data? But I think we really have to sort of turn around and give props to the idea of human learning, too. I mean, we are learning machines. That's what we do. And so can you see these data points? This is some very early data. This is actually our first experiment in Eterna. We said, build this shape. It's a super easy RNA shape. And this is the Eterna score on the y-axis, which is how well your molecule did when we synthesized it. And the higher, the better. And with plus or minus 5 points experimental error, we say that if you get a 95, you've basically solved the puzzle perfectly. You've built a molecule that folded exactly right. So as you can see, both the players, which are in red, and the computers, which are in blue, Incidentally, one of the funny things about this research is that you talk about humans sort of non-ironically. You're like, humans do this and humans do that. But obviously we are human, so it's a little bit odd. But anyway, the players and the computers did sort of all over the map, not particularly well. But Eterna players had access to this experimental loop of experiment, hypothesis, result. And over the course of the first 6 months of this experiment, a really remarkable thing happened, which is that the players got better and better and better at RNA nanoengineering. And in fact, 6 months into the experiment, the best computer result was worse than the worst player result. It's pretty astonishing. And so I was actually talking to one of the players on chat about just this phenomenon, Eli Fisker. He's one of the top players. And he said this really funny thing. He said, I felt a bit sorry for them. And he's talking about computers right now. He's like, they made all sorts of funny errors that we quickly outgrew. I actually made rules just because of the errors I saw the bots do. And then he goes on to explain the mistakes that computers were making that the people just sort of naturally stopped making. And so that's just a really exciting thing. And so it brings me to the fifth reason to crowdsource science, which is that humans create knowledge naturally. It's a byproduct of being human. And so to explain what I mean, I'm going to take us back to the very early days of Eterna when humans were really not doing that well. And this player called Dimension 9 wrote a blog post, sort of a clarion call to all the other players in the game. And this is what he said. I have been painstakingly going through most, if not all, of the new lab design submissions by brand new players. And I was chagrined to find a dozen Christmas trees were submitted. Okay. So a Christmas tree is a design which has lots of red and green in it, which are actually G's and C's. And when you play the Eterna tutorials, you're taught that G's and C's stick together very strongly, which they do. That's part of RNA folding. And so players were like, oh, well, if they stick together strongly, then I'm going to really win this game if I use tons of G's and C's. And he said, let us not waste even one of our precious few designs on these, because when we synthesized these Christmas trees, they weren't working in practice. And so Christmas trees and many other things have become sort of like technical terms within the Eterna scientific community. And this was this clarion call saying, look at the experimental results, and let's try and figure out what's going on here. And what it led to was this explosion of analysis by the players looking at every single molecule, nucleotide by nucleotide, and trying to figure out what happened. Why did it work sometimes, and why did it not work other times? This is an example of another blog post by a player called Chris Cunningham, taking apart this puzzle nucleotide by nucleotide. And this is just really exciting. And in fact, this is a paper written by one of the players for the benefit of other players in the game called a meta-analysis of one-cross bulge results. And I'm going to just zoom in on a little bit here. This is something which non-expert game players are writing to the community to try and beat this game. And I mean, I don't know what this looks like to you, but to me it looks like science. This is what science looks like. And this is what non-expert Eterna players are writing just to beat this game. It's pretty astonishing. And so that's going to take me to the sixth reason to crowdsource science, which is that I think that we're really creating new scientists. So when we started seeing players doing this amazing stuff, we were like, what's going on here? We need to have a way of understanding what players are doing. So we created this new sort of game within a game called the strategy market. And the way that it works is that we reward players for writing strategies in plain English. What are you doing when you create molecules? What are you looking for? What's important and what's not important? And they would post it on the game, and then we had a bunch of undergrads who were madly coding these up in Python for an entire summer, and then running each one of these strategies against our database of what works and what didn't work. And we're going to combine them all together to create something called the Eterna, what are we calling it? Oh yeah, the Eterna Ensemble Strategy. I swear I did create these games. The Eterna Ensemble Strategy. And what it is a mixture of the best strategies by players used to fold RNAs automatically. And it's really astonishing what's coming out. So this is an example of one of the strategies, and it was created by Eli Fisker, who's one of the players that I mentioned earlier. And if you know anything about biochemistry, this is really sort of an astonishing idea. If you look at those four red parts right there, those are the ends of what's called a multi-loop. And if you see, there's a G and a C on each one of the ends, which is a very stable thing to do. And what he said was, when you see a multi-loop, the G's and C's should always turn in the same way. So if you look clockwise around the loop, you'll see G, C, G, C, G, C, G, C. This is something that was completely unknown in biochemistry. And it turns out to be highly predictive of the stability of a molecule. And it was discovered by a non-expert librarian from Denmark. It's just really cool. And I mean, I think that this lays out a template for how to attack problems in which we don't quite know what the right thing to do is, which is convert the problem to a game, that's really easy, and then, I'm kidding, and then study the user solutions, and then create algorithms based on these solutions. And so you could say this is crowdsourcing, but crowdsourcing to me usually means we use computers to distribute lots of tasks to people. This is almost the opposite. It's like lots of people coming together to teach computers how to do something. And so we're creating these new scientists, and it's performing this inverse crowdsourcing task. But that's not all. I mean, we are really creating new scientists. So let me give you another example. We decided to have a summit meeting with our players. And we said, okay, if you guys want to talk to the scientists behind Eterna, come to chat on this day at this time. And so we had this rollicking chat session with the players. And they asked us something which really sort of blew us out of the water. At the time, we were just starting up, and we could only synthesize 8 RNAs per week, which is not that much. Now, by the way, we can synthesize 30,000 RNAs a week, which is leading to a whole interesting user interface challenges. We need to become the Google of RNA design, and we don't quite know how to do it. And if someone in the audience knows how to do this, we should really talk. But at the time, we could only do 8. And so we're having this summit meeting with the players, and they said, look, this game is awesome, we love it, but 8 RNAs a week, not cutting the mustard. So this is what we'd like to know. Could you please publish your experimental protocols and give us some idea how much it would cost to buy the chemicals? Because frankly, we'd like to be doing experiments ourselves in the background to move this thing along a little faster. And we were just totally floored by this. And I'm not actually sure what has come of this. I don't think anything has come of it yet, but it's sort of become this legendary idea called backyard biosense in Eterna. And I think it's a sign of how these games, when we inject them into society, really change the player communities of these games. Okay. So that, any questions up to this point? All right. So that takes me to the 7th reason to crowdsource science, which is always a fun one, breaking the rules. So this one happened a little surreptitiously. So when you're not actually building real molecules, Eterna players play these things called challenges, which are sort of little games on the computer where you try to beat the computer at designing molecules. And so when we launched the game, we had about 200 challenges or so. What happened was players were ferociously going through them so fast that we were running out of challenges, and we were getting really nervous, and just when everything was going to come to a head and our best player was going to beat the last challenge, our in-house puzzle creator, who was a graduate student, Snehal, left for a job in the financial services industry. So we were totally screwed, basically. And we decided, how can we get more challenges? And so we decided to crowdsource this problem, too. And we were like, okay, players, build challenges for one another. And so they started creating these hundreds or perhaps thousands of, they're called player puzzles. And all sorts of fun stuff came out of it. This is an RNA alphabet created by one of the players called Clolin. And then we started to realize that, wow, this is actually a scientific problem in its own right. And so we took all of the best computer algorithms in the world and we started to have them compete against the players to solve these player puzzles. And what this meant was that players were, in effect, searching for little errors in the computer algorithms. For example, this really simple zigzag motif was discovered by a player called Joshua Weitzman. And Eterna players know the solution to this problem, but it turns out that no algorithm could solve it, even though it's really simple. And so you might say, well, this doesn't seem like such a big deal. Let's just program the algorithms. When they see this, they will fix this problem. And of course, yes, that's actually exactly the point. The players have systematically found these little errors in the top scientific algorithms, and they're doing it at this ferocious rate. So you know, when people think about crowdsourcing today, they often think of these simple, you know, image and pattern recognition tasks. But I think, in fact, that crowdsourcing can be used to solve much, much more complicated problems, really at the limit of human knowledge. And that's very exciting. Okay, 8th reason to crowdsource science. There are a lot of humans. When we launched Eterna, we got 26 continuous man years of work in the first 6 months. And not only are there a lot of people, but they all work for free. And let me tell you, in academia, that's a big deal because everything costs money, right? Computers and graduate students and all this kind of stuff. And to have 30,000 people working to you for free is pretty amazing. And so the question is, why do all these people work for us for free? And one reason certainly is score. So it's just some kind of funny thing about human nature that if you, like, it's like cavemen with their rocks in their cave. As soon as you set this thing up, they want more rocks in their cave than the neighbor has in their cave. And it's really this astonishing thing that when you start to score people, they want to have more score than the next person. And in fact, my colleague, Luis Van An, made a really good point about players and score, which is don't just give them points, give them lots of points. And it really works. It's astonishing. But the other thing about crowdsourcing, or another reason why these players play these games, we discovered, is because we imbued them with science. And actually, an early mistake that we made in the games was that we tried to sublimate the science. We tried to make it so that you wouldn't even know you were doing science because we thought that was ultra cool. And then when we play-tested these games, we found exactly the opposite. It's that, you know, we who work in, like, science and technology and stuff forget that these fields actually have a real romance to them, actually. And people want to get involved in science. And as it turned out, the more science we imbued in these games, the more people wanted to play. And so this is just a little screenshot of some information that we give players as they're playing. But in so many ways, these games are sort of deeply, deeply imbued. It's actually a very hard thing to do with little bits of science. For example, when you play Eterna, the background is blue and has little rising bubbles. It's a subtle thing. It has nothing to do with the rest of the game, but it sort of subtly reminds you that this is all happening in water, which it is. And it's one of the sort of millions of little ways that we convey this to players. And so I actually really want to give my thanks to the design teams on both these games who worked hard to sort of do that properly. It's not a simple thing at all. And so that brings me to the last reason to crowdsource science, which is that it means a lot to players. It really does. And so I'm going to illustrate this with a little video.
With a protein that is so misshapen, it's ugly and it's red. And to work through that to a beautifully streamlined structure where it's symmetrical and things are tucked in and nothing is hanging out of the sides, yeah, that is sort of the goal. And that's what I like doing, to sort of help it in some ways to sort of be what it should be. I'm an administrative worker in the rehab team. I'm just answering telephones, working on bespoke computer programs, interacting with staff. It's very repetitive. When I go home, I become a different person. I just like to measure myself against something, and it's given me something that my everyday life hasn't given me. It's to just use abilities I didn't know I had.
So those are the 10 reasons, my 10 reasons to crowdsource science. And so I hope that through this sort of set of stories, I've managed to convince you that crowdsourcing science, it's not some kind of linear thing where you just hand problems to people and they solve them for you. It's this crazy non-linear thing where the players affect us and we affect the players, and all sorts of other crazy things come out of it. And I really think that we're just at the very, very beginning of this phenomenon. And there are so many interesting questions that I want to leave you with. Backwards biosynth, is it possible? Can we trust the results that the players are doing? Is it going to be dangerous? We're sort of in a legal gray area here, too. Who owns these designs, actually? What happens when people design something which is really medically useful? Do we pay cents to 300,000 players? I don't know. I think no one knows. Can we get the players to write papers without us? So up till now, the model has been players play the games and we write the papers. But the players have become so sophisticated, so knowledgeable about science. In fact, they're reading papers in the field written, you know, by last year by scientists. Why can't we just get them to write papers for us? Then we can literally abstract ourselves out of everything and do nothing. So I think there's going to be a lot of exciting news to present over the next 5 years in this field. And then if we turn ourselves back to the science, if we can make a dent in these problems like protein folding or nanoengineering, maybe we can save the world. So I want to thank the people who created these games with me. These are some of the principals. A lot more people were involved. Seth Cooper, Zoran, and David over at the University of Washington. G. Lee, my student at Carnegie Mellon, and Riju Das at Stanford, an amazing experimentalist who runs the entire experimental side of Eterna. So I want to thank all these people, and then I want to thank you all for listening. So, yeah, a question? Yeah, so I think that would be really exciting. Currently, Foldit, for technical reasons, is a download because there's a lot of like 3D math that goes on in it. Eterna, which is actually a little bit simpler of a game, is in Flash, which means that you can play it on cell phones. And we know that people are playing it on cell phones because they've asked us to like simplify the graphics and stuff. So there's now a cell phone mode of Eterna. But I think that would be really exciting. And social and mobile. Yeah. No, that's a really good idea. That's a really good idea. We hadn't considered charging for it.
Build a better machine algorithm and then kicks the human's ass.
Right, that's exactly right. Yeah, actually, there's in that video that I just showed you, That's a great question. In that video that I just showed you, there's actually another really sort of peaking moment when one of the players says, yes, I was the number one Foldit player in the world, but you know, we're all just waiting for computers to get better, and eventually we're all going to be folded out of the game. And that is actually true. But that's a really brilliant suggestion. And in fact, that's sort of what we're trying to do when I talk about the strategy market. We're taking what the players are doing and systematizing it and turning it into an algorithm. And in fact, a preview of the results, which are so new that they're not in there yet, is that that algorithm beats every other algorithm. It doesn't beat the players, though, which is interesting. So the players still have some tricks up their sleeves that we can't quite formalize yet. For a bit longer, yeah.
So congratulations on this fantastic project. And I guess there's a number of other similar things going on around the world, like the Polymath project, which did a somewhat similar thing in math. And then there's my company, Kaggle, which does a similar thing in data science. You know, one of the things that frustrates me is I look at, like, for example, some of the stuff Michael Nielsen talks about in open science in general is yes, we're creating new scientists, but the community of scientists is so hard to crack into. You know, the journals are pretty closed. There's kind of peer review. There's all this other stuff going on. Do you have any thoughts about, you know, how to actually open it up so that the world of, you know, real scientists and amateur scientists can kind of come together and work together more effectively?
Yeah, so the question was about further ways, I guess, of breaking down the barriers between real scientists, which really is sort of an elite, difficult to get into field. I mean, it requires lots of free time just to get a PhD, basically. And I think that is very much the point of what we're trying to do. And I think that these games are just one example of that happening. It is actually happening on many different facets. So PLOS1 is this open access journal where the idea is you don't get peer reviewed based on whether your ideas are important, which always enrages scientists. You get in only if your ideas are empirically valid, and then we let the comments and rating system ex post facto decide which ideas were really important and which were the seminal papers and so on and so forth. And in fact, we've been talking, we have a partnership with, we're establishing a partnership between Eterna and PLOS1 to allow the players to directly submit peer-reviewed results. So it is happening, And you know, for all the elitism of science, everyone on these projects admits that we are not nearly as good as our top players. Right, so the question is, are we getting a negative reaction from scientists? I think that we certainly did initially when people said, oh, you can't do this, and there's proteins are much too complicated, and people, this is a, you know, very flashy project. But we've subsequently published several high-profile, peer-reviewed, in the old-fashioned sense, papers. And I think that actually, in some sense, we've established our scientific credentials at this point. And you know, this is happening in other things. Galaxy Zoo is another crowdsourced science project which has really established its bona fides by doing serious science in this way. So I think that the people are much more receptive now. In fact, if anything, I hear too many times scientists calling me up saying, "Let's do this, and we'll make a game of that," and so on and so forth. So, yeah.
Hi. This is actually a somewhat similar question. I actually work at NIH and manage the web team there, and so I actually saw an article about your game a while ago and been trying to encourage, you know, these ideas. Right now, we get the public information out on social media, but we haven't quite gotten the science community to sort of tap into this. So how do you sort of overcome some of those, you know, resistance and that sort of thing? And do you think this is sort of a start of a change in how the science will work and research will work in the future? Or, like, what makes you unique and different from others in the science community who perhaps this is threatening to?
Well, I think that the question is, how can we, I guess, catalyze more quickly change in the scientific community? And I think that part of the elitism of science is actually good. We want to make sure that the results are real, and we want to have high-profile places to present those results. And so I think it's going to be by establishing scientific bona fides, by publishing serious papers. And, you know, if players weren't beating computers, then the experiment would have failed. It's falsifiable, right? But players are, and I think that people are coming around to the idea that we can actually do science that we can't do any other way with these large groups of people.
This is fascinating stuff. Thanks. Two questions. What have you learned or concluded about the comparative abilities of people versus computers? And then second, do you think humans will have the high ground for a long time longer or a short time longer?
So what have we learned about the differences between humans and computer thought? I actually wish I had an intelligent answer to that. It turns out that players are different, are good at different things than we thought every single time. So we thought they'd be good at taking a whole completely unfolded protein and folding that up from scratch. Weirdly, it turns out computers are much better at that than humans. But if you have a protein which is close to its folded state but has a couple errors, which you'd think, oh, that's something that a computer would be really good at, just fixing a few small errors, the players turn out to be good at that. So it's just, I don't quite know yet, but what I do know is that the key, I think, is to be fleet-footed. So I think these projects worked in part because as we saw players doing totally unexpected things, we rapidly sort of pivoted the games to give them tools to complement their strengths and allow them to do what they're good at fast. Yeah. Oh, for how much longer? That's the million-dollar question.
How did you get people to start playing in the first place? That's the first question. And secondly, you talked a little bit about the sorts of things that get people engaged, like telling them a bit more about the science. I'd be interested in hearing a bit more about the tricks and tips to getting people sort of more engaged.
Okay, so the first question was, how did we get people to play in the first place? And for all the awesomeness of, you know, viral marketing and stuff like that, really, both these games got a huge boost from the traditional media. So Foldit, there was a big article in The Economist right when it came out, and then Eterna, there was a big article in The New York Times. And a brief look at our Google Analytics logs tells us that they made a big difference. They gave us a lot of players. And then the growth became more organic, and you know, there were subsequent articles and stuff. But so I would be very frightened to launch a project which didn't have that sort of big media splash start. Luckily, these were weird enough that the major media wanted to cover them. But so that's how we got a lot of players, I would say. And then we sustained the communities. That was the second question. I could go into this for so long, so maybe we should talk afterwards. But a lot of the tricks that go into games, including things like juiciness, like stars and sounds, really carried over quite naturally into these games, and I think they've played a big role. No, we were kind of seat of our pantsing it, and subsequently we actually talked to some game designers who said you did this right and you did this wrong, and those have informed the subsequent design of the game. So the games have morphed a lot since their early days. If you saw like a version 1 Foldit or Eterna, you'd be like, oh my god, this looks so weird. Anyway, maybe two more questions?
Sure. So when you talked about incorporating what the humans had learned about techniques into the algorithms, I couldn't tell if it was just those particular examples of things that you could do, or if it was more about teaching the computers, sort of like learning what general purpose learning methods or what could have been done differently to make the algorithms. Does that make sense?
So I think what you're asking is, rather than ask the humans, give us a few specific tricks, is there a way that we could somehow train the computers to just sort of watch humans play and figure out what they're doing?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. That is a really fascinating problem, and if you know the answer, let me know. But it's really hard to tell what humans are doing, and to actually, it's interesting, you know, this, it gets to this question of what humans can do and what computers can do. Simply asking them turned out to be really simple and totally revelatory. People were thinking very, very specific things when they were designing these molecules, and they were working. And just
they could articulate what they were thinking and doing?
Yes, in some cases, they could articulate it, was the question. But there's still, even the best sort of trained by humans algorithm still can't beat the best humans. So there's an aspect of it that we haven't captured yet. Okay, now two more questions for real.
Thanks. kind of the way I was interpreting this is that you started with just computer models that were trying to accomplish these things, and the flaws in some of those were that they're codified knowledge, which doesn't necessarily expand or doesn't expand fast enough. And then you started talking about, as your players who are the dedicated players are thinking about these things, you're trying to augment the tool so that it is more in line with their way of thinking. But what I'm thinking about is that that's a self-selecting certain group of players, and as you migrate the tool set to match the way they attack the problem, you are in fact also codifying that solution approach. And I'm wondering if that's led to kind of thinking about, rather than have a protein folding game and an RNA game, if there are multiple different games that can get at the same problem, and maybe it is that, you know, to take the science out of it makes it more attractive to the 10-year-old that might play Halo rather than, you know, somebody that wants to understand that they're part of the scientific process, or that it's just a completely different mechanism. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that thinking.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, and I think I could paraphrase it by saying, are we over-optimizing for what had happened in the past and for a specific group of players? Certainly, to be perfectly honest, the really good science is coming from a small fraction of the most elite players of these games. That's actually not a bad thing, I think. It's sort of astonishing that we've been able to filter through 300,000 people and find those in the extreme end of the long tail who can accomplish this really esoteric task. You know, we've thought about the idea of, like, you know, launching twofold. It's like the twins experiment, right? A red team and a black team, and seeing how they evolve separately. The manpower. Nor initially did we really have the numbers of users that would make that possible. But we don't even do A/B testing, actually. So, okay. Well, let's go to this question, and then, yeah.
So, it's Jonathan Breyer from the University of Michigan. It's following up on that. What does your turnover look like? And you said you have a small set of players contributing the most to the scientific process, but what percentage actually come back on a regular basis to continue playing?
So I actually don't know the numbers, but most players who come in the door leave. So this isn't the game for everyone, and I think that's actually our failure in large part. We could do more to make these games accessible to more people. And I think that if we had 10 times larger audience, 100 times larger audience, 30 million players, there might actually be a phase transition there where all of a sudden we see really, you know, beyond what we're seeing now in terms of results. But right now these are sort of very specific games which appeal to a certain kind of person that gets obsessed with it. On the other hand, the top players are really obsessed, and that's awesome. Oh, awesome. You're one of our early players. Right on. Okay. Well, thank you guys very much. Those were great questions.